Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Thousands of troops are on the move in Afghanistan. With the Afghans in the lead, soldiers from NATO are pouring into Helmand Province, poised to launch a major offensive to drive the Taliban from Marja. Far from a surprise attack, this operation has been publicized well in advance. We're joined now by retired Colonel Sam Gardner. He taught military strategy at the National War College and the Naval War College. Good morning.
Good morning.
What do you think about this strategy of publicizing this offensive in advance in order to give insurgents a chance to flee?
Not the invasion of Normandy. This is an operation that reflects the complexities of Afghanistan. Part of the reason for the notification is so that President Karzai can't back out of the operation. Part of the reason for the notification is to give mid-level Taliban a chance to turn sides. Another reason is that the United States would like the civilians to stay in place and the Afghans want the civilians to leave. Complexity of the Afghan problem.
It is a complex problem. Retired Colonel Sam Gardner, stay with us. We'll be talking with you more details. The Marja offensive begins in Afghanistan. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 10th, and the takeaway for me, John, is that comparisons fall apart when you get to Afghanistan. It is complex, as Sam Gardner said, and you can't compare it with other offensives.
Well, you'll have to see if those things actually take place, if the civilians do stay, if the Taliban does flee, and if publicizing the invasion isn't more of a mistake because it actually signals that the Taliban can go run and hide. But let's get right to the headlines we're following this morning, and that's all about a big snowstorm that's sweeping the Northeast this morning, as much as a foot of snow, additional snow to Washington, D.C. Baltimore and Philadelphia are in the mix. The snow is even falling here in New York City. We're joined now by Greg Shore, meteorologist at the National Weather Service. He's in Sterling, Virginia, near Dulles Airport. Greg, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
So where does this storm track now, and is it going to peak later on in the morning, or have we seen the worst?
Well, the second round of basically round two is starting right now. It's, over the past hour, we've had snow bands just sort of developing straight around us, all the way from Lake Erie down into Southern Virginia, back up toward New York City. The whole area is just filling in with light to moderate snow. We had an average of about 2 to 4 inches overnight late last night. Then we had a brief lull, not much activity, so it seemed like not much was happening. But then in the past hour, just as we'd predicted, the surface low just off the coast is deepening rapidly, and that's going to pick up winds this afternoon. We've got some blizzard warnings for, like, the Baltimore metro area all the way over into parts of the central Appalachians, and we are looking to see another couple of inches over the metro areas, maybe.
So this storm has a chance, at the very least, to deliver what was promised. It's certainly a huge storm, that's for sure. Greg Shore, meteorologist at the National Weather Service, speaking to us about this eastern storm from Sterling, Virginia.
The crisis engulfing Toyota is threatening to hit new tights. There's another recall to tell you about, this time for more than 7,000 2010 Camrys that also have a problem with the brakes. And on top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on the Toyota Corollas. No official investigation, though, has been opened.
Stormy weather for Toyota. Let's look at the markets. Asian and European markets are up now. Futures are up, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. Another rally expected today. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ opens at 2150. Coming up, Valentine's Day, fast approaching. But how do you make a meal for your sweetheart that will knock him or her off their feet? We talk with the Food Network's Gina and Pat Neely later this hour, and I'm telling you, this interview gets hot.
It's a snow day for lots of Americans and thousands upon thousands of American children. Give us your memories of snow days growing up, 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. We get more details of the Marja offensive in Afghanistan in a moment.
You You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
As we speak, thousands of U.S., British, and Afghan soldiers are poised to push into a Taliban stronghold in the area of Marja in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. The town is one of the last strongholds of the Taliban in this mountainous area, and it's the center of the opium trade for insurgents as well. Traditionally, strategists like to use the element of surprise, but this operation has been widely publicized for at least a week or two in advance. Here's U.S. and NATO Commander Stanley McChrystal speaking a couple days ago.
We're trying to make this not a military operation only, but a civilian and military operation, because really the thing that's changing is going to be the level of security in the area, but the governance.
Let's go now to Captain Abraham Sipe. Captain Sipe is a public affairs officer at Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan, and the Marines at Camp Leatherneck will form the main column of this assault. Good morning, Captain.
Hey, good morning. How are you today?
Can you respond to this description by General Stanley McChrystal that this is going to be not just a military offensive, but a civilian offensive as well, cooperation with the civilian side? How is the civilian government of Afghanistan coordinating?
It absolutely is going to be both a military and civilian effort. The military portion, the clear portion of the operation is just one small part of an overall strategy to bring Marja back into the fold and return the legitimate government of Afghanistan to a government presence to the city of Marja.
Can you explain the strategy of warning people in advance that this offensive is coming? Is that expected to make the Taliban flee, or is it just the residents that are fleeing the area?
We don't necessarily have a big problem with the enemy fleeing Marja. If the enemy flees Marja, then it'll make it a lot more conducive to us returning and providing those services and returning security and stability to the city. And the numbers of families leaving Marja right now, our estimates are a lot less than what has been reported in the press. But we hope that as soon as possible we can make Marja a place where the citizens feel very safe and secure once we can get the legitimate Afghan national security forces and government returning to the city.
But Captain Sipe, when you warn the enemy in advance, aren't you taking the risk that they're going to dig in their heels, that they're going to hide in various places around the city, that they're going to have time to plant IEDs and other booby traps around the area?
Well, I'll tell you, I've been here for 9 months with Task Force Leatherneck, and Marja has been there the entire time. So it's not, they've been dug in Marja for quite some time. I'm not sure that we think that the added risk that we might be taking by giving a warning is actually going to be outweighed by the benefits of letting the people know that, hey, this is what we're about to do, and we're doing it for the long-term safety and security of your homes and your livelihoods.
We're also told that ISAF is aiming to get a 1-to-1 ratio with one Afghan for every NATO soldier, but number one, can you achieve that? And number two, are these forces, many of them are Pashto recruits that you guys have specifically targeted, are they well-trained? Are they well-equipped?
I'm not going to discuss specific numbers right now, but I can say that we've done one major operation when we started this this deployment. It was called Operation Kanjar in July. And in July, we had about 4,000 ISAF service members partnered with about 650 Afghan National Security Forces. And that's about a 7 or 8 to 1 ratio. I can tell you that the ratios of ISAF to Afghan National Security Forces for this operation are going to be very closer to a 1-to-1 ratio. I don't think that we can say it's a 1-to-1 ratio at this time, and I'm not going to discuss specific numbers, but it will be a large Afghan National Security Force presence during the operation and also after the operation to come in and restore order into the city.
Captain Abraham Sipe is a public affairs officer at Camp Leatherneck in Afghanistan. Let's return now to a military analyst, retired Colonel Sam Gardner. Colonel, I wanted to get your thoughts about this planned offensive in Marja. Do you think this strategy of moving into the Helmand province is a good one?
Well, it's uncontrolled territory. It's not governed by the Afghan government. If the United States' ultimate objective of turning over control to the Afghans is going to be achieved, we got to do it. It's also, as you actually mentioned earlier, a center of opium production. That's a big problem. Although it may not be the primary source of income now for the Taliban, it is a major source of income. So the strategic objectives demand that something be done about it.
Well, could we get into the situation where we're playing whack-a-mole, where we move them out of Marja, they're just going to move their forces to another area and dig in somewhere else?
Oh, certainly. And in fact, that's the danger of the advance notification. However, reports coming from civilians who are fleeing there suggest that that's not happening. The civilians that are coming out are saying that the Taliban are digging in for a big fight. It doesn't look like that's going to happen. Some of the civilians that come out could in fact be Taliban, but it looks like it's going to be a big fight.
Well, we're getting reports that there's somewhere between 400 and 1,000 Taliban in Marja. If they're digging in, doesn't the Taliban really have everything to gain here, even if they lose soldiers, in terms of being treated like a real, respectable, credible insurgent force? Isn't that, in terms of PR, a good thing for them?
Well, the real critical thing is how the Afghans react. This is as much a test of the Afghan police and military as it is a test for, the General McChrystal's strategy. How they perform is what we need to watch very carefully.
Okay, return to Colonel Sam Gardner. He taught military strategy at the National War College and at the Naval War College. We are also joined earlier by Captain Abraham Sipe, Deputy Public Affairs Officer at Camp Levin in Afghanistan. Captain Sipe, are you still there?
I am, yes.
When does the offensive really actually begin? The official offensive?
I've not been doing this job for that long, but I can't. I know not the answer to one of those.
You don't know that.
Just a test. Just a test. There, that's all we're doing. And I love your cell phone. What is that on your cell phone?
The ring, you mean?
I'm
yeah.
not sure what you're referring
there's
to.
A, yeah. There's a great cell
a
phone ring.
Catchy
yeah.
cell phone yeah. ring. We were wondering if that was
Righteous
yours.
Soul.
Oh, did you catch that? Yeah.
yeah.
That's, I've got I literally have five phones on my desk, and in order for me to tell which one.
They'll be ringing today.
Public Affairs Officer, thanks so much, Captain Sipe. It's 15 minutes past the hour now. Let's check in on the headlines.
Grim death count in Haiti. The government now says it believes 230,000 people were killed in last month's earthquake, close to the number of people killed in the Asian tsunami 5 years ago. And the figures are up nearly 20% from the last estimate. Here at home, weather woes are the big story along the East Coast today. Snow totals will vary across the Mid-Atlantic region. Bob Orovec, lead forecaster for the National Weather Service, has some details.
Snowfall totals of anywhere from 6 to 12 inches are expected across the Washington, D.C. and Baltimore metropolitan areas. And as you go farther northward from Philadelphia up to New York City, the amounts are expected to be in excess of a foot.
Hundreds of flights have been canceled in anticipation of what's being described as a major storm.
Overseas in Afghanistan, avalanches have killed more than 150 people along a key road that connects Kabul with the north. Rescuers are working for a third day to reach those still trapped. More than 2,000 people have been rescued so far. We've been reporting about Toyota's problems for weeks, but today Honda takes the spotlight. Another 437,000 cars have been added to Honda's faulty airbag recall. The company is replacing the driver's side airbag in five models. In U.S. retail sales, not including cars, rose more than 3% in January. That's compared to the same month last year. It's the third month of gains in a row. And finally, bring a sweater if you're flying American Airlines. In May, the airline will start charging $8 for a blanket and a pillow on all its domestic flights.
How do they determine
flights?
Oh, we can't charge
look
seven.
At some of the stories you're watching
eight.
This morning.
I mean, how do they figure that?
Coming up, the First Lady's hoping to combat childhood obesity. For tips on how to do that, we actually turn to adults. We've got your weight loss success stories coming up in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our news takeouts this morning come from Washington, come from international business, and we explore a truism. I don't know whether it's good or bad, but people love to talk about weight loss. You know, go figure.
They do.
Later on, you'll hear some of your remarks. But first, we go to Capitol Hill. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. The reporters were surprised yesterday when Barack Obama stepped to the podium and delivered an impromptu and surprise news conference.
This gives an opportunity not just for Democrats to say, here's what we think we should do, but it also gives Republicans a showcase before the entire country to say, here's our plan, here's why we think this will work. And you know, one of the things that John Boehner and Mitch McConnell both said is they didn't think that the status quo was acceptable. And that's right there promising.
So Todd Zwillick, Barack Obama talking about how chummy he is all of a sudden with John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, the key Republicans who are fighting him on health care reform. Is this right. plan to bring everybody under a single tent with the cameras rolling going to work?
Well, we'll see. You know, there's a strong indication just overnight, John. There's a new Washington Post ABC poll out that probably sheds some light on why the president is doing this. You know, 57% of those polled said it was a good thing that Democrats lost their 60-vote filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. But an equal number said that the GOP isn't doing enough to find compromises with the president. So this, what this is turning into is a little bit of a game of chicken that the president sort of has control over. Hey, I'm going to reach out or appear to be reaching out. Republicans, your strategy of opposition, which has worked so well so far, this poll also showed that Republicans are gaining in the polls. This strategy that has worked so well so far, see if he can disarm them a little bit and force them into some cooperation. It's a bit of a game of chicken.
All right, well, we'll talk to you later this week to see if anyone blinks at all. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Let's turn now to Louise Story, the Wall Street and Finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And Louise, we heard that China has added another title to its resume. They knocked Germany out of their long-held spot as the world's top exporter. What exactly does this mean? China ready to take over the world?
China is on the rise, Celeste. They had $1.2 trillion in exports in 2009, and Germany only had $1.1 trillion. If you remember back in 2003, Germany surpassed the U.S. in terms of exports. So now China's at the top. Everyone's going to be watching for other milestones from China. It's on track now to replace Japan as the world's second largest economy soon behind the U.S. And then the question will be, when does it replace the U.S. as the largest economy? That's, you know, a lot further off, and it's still a question.
Well, China, they did overtake Germany as the top exporter, but their trade fell last year.
Right, but Germany's exports fell a lot more. Germany exports a lot of its goods to the rest of Europe, and you know Europe is having a lot of problems over there, and they're not buying as much. And so Germany's fell almost 20%.
So this is a status symbol? Is this a symbolic title that they have, or does this mean something in terms of their future?
No, this is not symbolic. This is real money. This is business. The more that countries are exporting, the more money that they're bringing in for their own residents to educate them and to improve their standard of living. So this is a true change in the economy, and it means a lot for our global economy.
Okay, Louise Story is the finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
It'd be interesting to sort of compare the product mix from Germany versus China. You know, the BMWs from Germany, the machine sort of value-added products versus a lot of raw manufactured materials from China. It's an interesting
and
sort of
And we've had trouble
picture.
With a lot of the exports coming out of China as well,
well
in
there,
terms
there
of
is,
quality control. That's an issue.
And Germany's had some problems as well, but very interesting. Our last takeout is listeners crowing about weight loss. And I have to say, some of them made me a little bit nervous here. The First Lady announced that new initiative to combat childhood obesity yesterday, and we thought it's kind of hard for people to lose weight, okay? And we asked, let's get some tips from our listeners, the wisdom of our listeners. Sounds like there was a lot of success stories.
I lost about 30 pounds.
And I've just lost 61 pounds.
Lose 30 pounds in one summer.
I've dropped about 100 pounds, and my quality of life is just so much better.
You know, maybe we should start a cable show here. It's just a sample of stories you're telling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE and posting to our site, thetakeaway.org.
There's a couple of different categories in terms of how people found weight loss success. There's exercising more.
This is Ann Arlen from New York City. My tea is working out four times a week. If I do that, I can eat anything I want anytime. And I get stronger, and it's fun.
My name is Val. I'm from Rhode Island. I just recently lost about 100 pounds, and it's just all about moving. And I'm not eating any less. I'm eating more, but of the right food. Move more, and just keep eating all day.
Also on our weight loss plan from you, the issue of what it is you're putting in your mouth.
This is Allison from New Jersey. I lost weight by cutting out carbs. I don't eat dessert, and I don't drink soda, and I lost 15 pounds. People were wondering how I did it.
My name is Ty. I'm from Hanover, Massachusetts. I became a vegetarian about 5 years ago, and over the course of those 5 years, I've lost over 30 pounds and feel healthier and great.
That is great. All of you contacted us at 877-8-MY-TECH. I love this slogan, move more and just keep eating. But remember, it's the quantity of how much you eat that's important.
My name is Maytel. I'm calling from Edison, New Jersey, and the way I keep my weight down is I take tiny bites of my food and really savor it, and I eat slowly. And by the time I'm done eating, I'm only eating half my food, and everyone else is completely done.
This is Russell Oak from Miami. My advice is to actually eat more. What you need to do is just eat small portions throughout the day, particularly the most important, right away in the morning to get your metabolism going. And then instead of eating three large meals, instead just eat small meals throughout the day. That'll get your metabolism moving and help you burn fat.
And, of course, this is a global story.
My name's John Mark. I'm from Australia. I've moved from Australia 3 weeks ago, and I am amazed at the size of your portions in restaurants. It is, without any exaggeration, twice, sometimes three times the portion that we get served in restaurants in Australia. You could solve problems overnight if you halved portion sizes in this country.
I'll take that portion super small, okay? Here's some advice from the Aussies there. 877-8 My Take, your weight loss tips. It never ceases to amaze me that people love to talk about this. My Take at thetakeaway.org. My weight loss tips? I don't have any. Can't you tell?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, with all the proliferation of electronic media, in Haiti, it was good old radio. It was the technology people turned to the most. The reliability of radio in times of disaster, that's the story we're going to talk about in just a few moments. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. Toyota has another recall to tell you about. 7,000 2010 Camrys have a problem with their brakes, and 7,000 of those vehicles will be recalled. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. No official investigation has been opened. Here's Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood.
We are going to hold Toyota's feet to the fire when it comes to these recalls. We are looking into all aspects of complaints that have come to our department.
He was speaking to NBC News. Honda now has added another 400,000 cars in the U.S. to its global recall for faulty airbags. The number two automaker has been recalling cars since 2008. Today's latest expansion includes certain Accords, Civics, and Acuras. In Haiti, the government has raised the death toll for last month's earthquake to 230,000, making the disaster as deadly as the 2004 Asian tsunami. Officials say it doesn't include bodies buried in private ceremonies.
Here at home, former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich heads to court today. He'll face a new batch of charges that he schemed to sell President Obama's old Senate seat and swap official favors for campaign money. In the markets, futures are up. The Dow will start at 10,058, the S&P at 1,070, and the NASDAQ opens at 2150. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
You know, in times of crisis, it's radio that often becomes the real information lifeline. Used to be shortwave radios were the only information channels in far-flung parts of the world during times of disaster. These days, radio is joined by other forms of electronic communication, Twitter, Facebook. We saw all of them out in force in Haiti as people struggled after the worst earthquake there in 200 years. The death toll now estimated at 230,000, which is on par with the Asian tsunami of 2004, where radio played an important role back in 2004 in the tsunami as well. In Haiti, radio ran down the rumors. Radio told people where to get food and medical help and how to reconnect with loved ones. Radio was special during the earthquake, and radio also has a very special place in Haitian culture. It's back in force on the island. Emilio San Pedro is an editor for Connexion Haiti, a lifeline program created by our partner, the BBC, to help Haitians get all kinds of basic information that is still needed since the earthquake. Emilio, good morning.
Good morning.
Emilio is with us from Miami, where the Connexion Haiti is broadcast from. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. And also, Michael Dibert joins us. He's a freelance journalist and author of Notes from the Last Testament, The Struggle from Haiti. And you were part of our coverage in those very early days, Michael. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much.
Describe, Michael, first of all, your sense of the importance of radio in Haiti and the importance of radio information sources during this earthquake.
Well, I would say in Haiti, you know, where newspapers are kind of few and far between in the best of times, I mean, radio plays a particularly important role in terms of disseminating information. And certainly in the aftermath of this really devastating earthquake, some of the stations that were able to continue broadcasting really played a very important role in terms of telling people what was happening with their family members, in terms of telling people where food was distributed, where aid was being distributed, things like that, even though the radio stations in Haiti had also suffered quite badly.
And because so many of the stations were off the air, the BBC saw that there was a need, and here's a feel for Connexion Haiti.
Objectif nou simple, c'est ba information important pour millions haïtiens tremblement de terre là affecté. Information vitale.
Emilio San Pedro, that's a part of a air check from Connexion Haiti. Why did the BBC decide to do this? And you're broadcasting in Creole there. What's the mission of Connexion Haiti?
Well, the mission is very simple. It's to bring that basic information that you were talking about, because even though the earthquake may have happened nearly a month ago now, it's still very early days in the whole relief and recovery effort. So it's still about giving people in Haiti a place where they can talk about the earthquake, because after all, these are all people who survived what is arguably the worst natural disaster ever in the Western Hemisphere.
We were speaking with Emilio San Pedro, who's editor for Connexion Haiti, with our partner, the BBC, and Michael Dibert, who's a freelance journalist and author of Notes from the Last Testament, The Struggle from Haiti. So Emilio had his own emotional story to tell us. There was a program recently where he was able to use radio to reunite some of the people who hadn't spoken since the earthquake itself. And on this program, a young boy in Haiti spoke with his mother, who lives in Boston. This story is going to be airing on the BBC World Service on Thursday. And in the story, the mother was so overjoyed she found out that her son was alive that she broke out into song, singing the religious hymn, How Great Thou Art. Here's a short excerpt. Emilio, tell us the story about the day when the mother was reunited with her son on the air. I mean, what was it like to be a radio host that day?
That was indeed one of the most incredible, and I've worked in radio for a long time here in the U.S. and in the U.K. It was the most incredible day, because for several days we've been getting text messages from this 16-year-old, Pinez Macari, who started texting us last weekend and saying, you know, I need to find my mom. I haven't talked to her since the earthquake, and he lives in Haiti. She lives in Boston. And he sent us a phone number, but it was the wrong number, unfortunately. So we then took the unusual step of actually directing an on-air message to one person. You know, Pinez, you've given us the wrong number twice now. Can you try? We really do want to help. Give us the number again. And he sent the right number. We got in touch with this lady, Simone, who lives in Boston. She's an American citizen. And Simone was, to say that she was distraught is an understatement of the highest proportions. I mean, Simone had not heard from her son since the earthquake. That was about, at that time, 3 weeks. She hadn't spoken to him. And they used to speak every single day. So the day that we called her to tell her that he was indeed alive and that we had been making contact with him, she was overjoyed. She told us that she hadn't eaten or drunk and barely slept for those 3 weeks. And she had her bags packed, ready to go to Haiti. It was unbelievable. They finally did manage. We managed to get them on a phone line. And it was quite an incredible feeling.
And a testimony to the power of radio. Michael Dibert, do you think that this is a moment? You hear Emilio San Pedro there talking about the texting and the interactivity becoming a radio broadcast. Do you think this is a real moment for the kind of coherence of all these electronic media coming together into some form that really does tell the story?
Well, yeah, I must say, I mean, in addition to the traditional forms such as radio in Haiti, I mean, you would be amazed at the role that, I mean, even social networking sites like Facebook played in kind of spreading information in terms of where people were trapped, who was alive, who was dead. And the thing is, I suppose, now the big question is how do we take all these kind of technological advances and use them in a way that does effectively, for example, get aid to people who don't have it and helps people who are trapped. I mean, when I was there, even up to 2 weeks after the earthquake, you know, you still had huge swaths of Port-au-Prince, which had barely been touched, really, by relief efforts. And so obviously that's something that, you know, on the ground in Haiti, radio is working, and perhaps internationally, you know, social networking sites and whatever are working to spread information about that.
And working together. Well, the important radio is important to us for obvious reasons, but it's great to hear this story coming out of Haiti. Michael Dybert, freelance journalist and author of Notes from the Last Testament, The Struggle from Haiti. We're also joined by Emilio San Pedro, editor for Conexión Haiti, with our partner, the BBC, broadcasting to Haiti from Miami. Thanks to you both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It always seems like disasters, like September 11th. It shows us the power of these low-tech solutions.
Well, these reconnections, these reunion stories that they were describing remind me of the pulling people from the rubble stories that you see on TV. You know, this is something that electronic media can do, reuniting people, creating these emotional moments. It's interesting.
It is interesting. And speaking of emotional moments.
Oh, yes, it's coming up, right? Valentine's Day?
It is. Not important to men often, but important to women and important to couples. And one thing you can do if you're a couple is instead of going out to eat this year, try cooking at home. We're going to be talking about that in just a few minutes. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And Jonas Hosmer, are you there?
Yes, I am.
You got your White House press pass around your neck there?
Nope, but...
You got one, right?
What? I should.
Yeah, well, you've got one, right?
Yeah, I got one, definitely.
Does it say on it that you're 11 years old?
Nope.
But it does say that you're a kid reporter for Scholastic, right? Scholastic News?
Yes, that's big capital letter sign on it.
Congratulations, where you have the lead story about Michelle Obama's initiative announced yesterday, Let's Move, an anti-obesity campaign. She announced it. There was a whole core of reporters there. You were among them. And I'm sure you heard the First Lady say this. Listen.
There is a place in this life for cookies and ice cream and burgers and fries. That is a part of the fun of childhood. Often it's just about balance.
So Jonas Hosmer, one of the people who reported that story, you weren't actually in the room with the First Lady, right? You were sort of outside looking at it on a screen.
I was at White House Live on watching it on the computer, and then I called in and listened to the press conference.
Is it interesting to you how the White House determines which reporters get to be actually in the room and in the photo, and which reporters sort of have to look at these live electronic channels?
I don't know. I think it's actually kind of cool, but so.
So it didn't affect your sense of the experience at all that you weren't actually able to meet the First Lady yesterday?
No.
All right, so what is this story? What's the angle here for kids?
That it's not, like Michelle Obama said, that it's not bad to eat burgers and fries. It's just people are eating them too much, and you want to slow them down and have them once-in-a-while treats.
All right, and she really personalized the story here, and I want to get your assessment of how well you think she did communicating here.
One day, my pediatrician, thankfully, was someone who's already doing what the American Academy is going to do, pulled me aside and told me, you might want to think about doing things a little bit differently. And for me, that was my moment of truth.
So Michelle Obama has had this sort of, you know, tracking obesity happen in her life.
Yeah.
Do you have a personal angle on your story?
Like a definition? Wait.
Well, no. I mean, if you struggled with weight loss, do you, you know, have like that third bowl of Cap'n Crunch in the morning sometimes?
Well, yeah, sometimes. But usually, like sometimes I'll, when I like I go for a snack, everyone wants cookies or like a package of granola bars, and my mom always says, "You want some fruit?" So.
Did you put that in your story in Scholastic?
Nope.
So just the facts.
Yeah.
How do you think Michelle Obama did? And, you know, the interview you really want to get is with those kids, right?
Yeah, I thought the kids of the interview would be it would be kind of cool to interview the kids, not because to see what it was like from their point, but because they were bored to death on the TV.
Interesting.
So I would have seen what they would have said.
That's your next story, Jonas Hosmer. You know, the two kids in the White House sort of bored to death with this presidency business.
Yeah.
That's a great story. Jonas Hosmer is a Scholastic Kid reporter reporting on the Let's Move campaign. You can see his story, the lead story in Scholastic News, on our website, thetakeaway.org. Thanks, Jonas.
Welcome.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. Coming up.
Love you.
Love food. Valentine's Day, our food segment this Wednesday, features the Food Network's Gina and Pat Neely. That's in a few moments. They're going to talk about love and food, and we're going to have a little Barry White on the show this morning. Right now, here's a check of leading stories that are coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama says he's willing to sign a health care bill, even if it doesn't deliver everything he wants.
My hope is that we can find enough overlap that we can say this is the right way to move forward, even if I don't get every single thing that I want.
The president also says the nation isn't happy with constant partisan wrangling over legislative proposals like health care.
The public has soured on the process that they saw over the last year. I think that actually contaminates how they view the substance of the bills.
Meanwhile, Congress has opened an investigation into rate increases by the Anthem Blue Cross Health Insurance Company in California. It's asked the CEO to testify later this month.
In Greece, flights are suspended and hospitals are operating on emergency-only service. That's because public sector workers across the country are on strike to protest government measures to tackle the country's huge deficit. And the Japanese carmaker Honda has announced the recall of almost 400,000 vehicles worldwide. That's citing safety concerns over passenger airbags. We're joined for details now by the BBC's Russell Padmore in London. Russell, good morning.
Celeste, good morning to you.
What is the problem with these cars that are being recalled?
It's a bit of a worry, I think, if you're a Honda car driver. We know the company's been recalling its vehicles for more than a year now, but it's doubled that amount. In Canada and the US now, we're going to see 419,000 Civics, Accords, Odysseys, and the small SUV, the CRV recalled. Effectively, the problem is the airbag goes off when you don't want it to. The real danger, metal shards fly out. This is on the driver's side of the vehicle, and this has really worried the safety regulators, who've effectively called Honda to account. I suppose we should add, of course, we're having real problems at Toyota as well. That's probably prompted Honda to do something about it in a much, much stronger way.
And they're worried that they're going to get more recalls and an official investigations, as has happened to Toyota.
Well, we know that in the Honda case, the airbag problem has already been linked to one death of a person and many other injuries. Toyota itself, we know, is recalling 8 million vehicles around the world, a faulty gas pedal on some of them. It's not very good if you think the gas pedal sticks down, you can't stop the car. Also, on top of that, we have the Prius, the brakes not working properly, a worry for these two Japanese manufacturers selling cars in North America.
Russell Padmore from our partner, the BBC. Those are some of the stories we're watching this morning.
On Valentine's Day, romance usually starts at the table. How many restaurant reservations are made for Valentine's Day?
Thousands.
Hundreds of billions of them, yes. Couples go out to a special restaurant. They gaze into each other's eyes over someone else's cooking. But what about bringing the romance right into your own kitchen?
You just want to flip it. And remember, we had butter on it, so it should come right out.
That's my man.
Woo! Oh, give me some, girl.
Good job, Pat.
You are not listening to flirtation there. No, that is true love. Pat and Gina Neely are high school sweethearts and co-hosts of the Food Network show Down Home with the Neelys. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Thank you.
Happy
Valentine's Day to you guys.
We wanted to invite you into the studio in Memphis, Tennessee, where we're on the air and where you're from, right?
Correct. Yes.
And share some of your recipes and really some of your strategies for making the kitchen a place for cooperation, as well as coming up with strategies to really attract the love of your life, right?
Correct.
Now, we don't want to get into the age thing too much, but you guys do go way back.
Yeah, we met in high school. We dated throughout our senior year, and then Pat and I actually broke up, and we got back together at our 10-year reunion. You know, that 10 years, we just kind of marinated and sautéed, and when I saw him, I had to go ahead and whip it on up.
It was a real reunion.
Now, Gina, how did food figure into the reunion and the rekindling of your love?
Well, you know what? Pat is sort of an old school kind of guy, very, very family oriented. And I always say, there are three ways to get a man. You start with his head, you get his heart, you get that stomach popping. So after he ate that great meal of mine that I prepared, that Get Your Man Chicken.
It was on.
It was a wrap.
It's called Get Your Man Chicken?
Yes.
It's called and Pat is a huge lover of chicken, so it's tooling around trying to think of a way that I can incorporate chicken into it, but kind of make the aroma have a sensuous kind of smell to it. So when you enter my home, it have that smell, and then you can hear the...
Set the stage here, all right? This is the recipe portion of the program. Get Yo Man chicken, chocolate brownie crunch, braised cabbage and carrots with southern creamed corn. That was the meal that really did the deed?
The meal that sealed the deal.
Oh, man.
Better stop, John. Better stop.
Give us you talked a little bit about the spices and the ambiance you wanted when Pat walked into the room, but how did you achieve that?
Okay, so what I did first, I kind of lit some candles. I had me a glass of wine first to sort of settle my nerves down. Because you know what? When you're in the kitchen, you want to kind of relax and even let the aromas kind of feed your soul as well as the person that you're preparing it for. So I started with the Get Your Man chicken, a little wine going, put a little tomato sauce in it, which is kind of similar to almost a chicken cacciatore, but right. Has a little twist to it. Then I went on and did the braised cabbage. And braising cabbage basically means you fry it in the skillet, where it's really a lot quicker than the old-fashioned way of boiling it. Added some carrots for a little color. Got a little cream corn going. Mm-mm, mm-mm. Then I said, you know what? Every great meal needs a little what at the end, a little something sweet. So we did the chocolate brownie crunch. We did a chocolate ganache on top. And I added in a cookie wafer just to kind of throw them off a little bit. Chill that champagne, honey, and when that man ate that food, them candles lit, had that aroma going.
Had some Barry White playing.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, my God. So, Pat, that's the attractive quality of food. There's also the cooperative quality of actually doing it together, in the kitchen. And, in my case, when I start cooking at home, my wife worries about the cleanup. What are some recipes that can keep things simple but keep it all romantic?
Well, you know, you got to work with your wife and your spouse in general. And Gina and I, for years, even before we started having kids and when they were little, you know, if she got home before I did and she started preparing the meal, as opposed to me coming in, plopping down on the sofa, I would immediately come in, wash my hands, and jump right in. If she had potatoes going, I would start mashing them, or I would start pulling the meat out of the oven or putting it in. And so we always just kind of work.
Listen, you guys are too much, man. Look at that. Whoa, turn down the thermostat in that studio.
Be there, right?
Here's the thing, though. For me, this food can be a source of tension because not only is he a terrible cook, but, you know, we don't agree on how healthy the recipe should be and whether or not, you know, pizza in and of itself constitutes a full 3-course meal.
You know, cooking is like a dance. You lead, I follow. There's a lot of compromising that goes on, finding your strengths and weaknesses. Like, I don't like to chop onions because I have terrible allergies. So if you notice on the show how Pat does all my chopping, and I may be working the spices because I like to mix it up. So what you do is you sort of find your strengths and weaknesses, just like in a relationship, where you can find, because most times you'll find that if you don't get along in the kitchen, more than likely that bedroom ain't so hot either.
Oh, man, that's great. All right, so Pat, let's get your loving in the oven menu, and all this stuff's going to be on our website.
Well, you know, we had the flank steak.
Nice.
And then we had the garlic mashed potatoes.
Excellent.
And to top it off, guys, you've got to have some strawberries. So I would make a chocolate syrup, which was more of a fondue. And then I would turn around and dip the strawberries into the chocolate. And I would feed Gina the strawberries.
Oh, that's good.
Which is a tribute to his meat and potatoes.
That's good. Well, it sounds like it's working very well, guys. Finally, any dishes that are things to absolutely avoid if you're going to do Valentine's Day at home as a couple?
First of all, you don't want to do things that are too complicated. Now, I won't be trying to fix my man no collard greens on Valentine's Day. Right. Let's just cut that out altogether. Maybe go with the grilled asparagus, something that's a lot lighter. Any kind of stews where it just kind of requires a lot of work and a lot of chopping, because you don't want things that are too heavy that's going to kind of weigh it down. Because if you weigh his stomach down, you're going to wear it the whole night will be weighed down. So you don't want that.
I definitely
don't
want.
Keep it light in the air.
Keep it light.
And feeling good.
Keep it easy.
It's one thing that I'd like to say is that cooking is just like a marriage, as Gina alluded to earlier. It's really about, you know, you guys working together and preparing a great meal that you both can enjoy.
If you make manwich, make it great. Who cares what it is? Just make it great and make it with love.
Pat and Gina Neely, co-hosts of the Food Network show, Down Home with the Neelys. Thanks so much, and happy Valentine's Day. I mean, I don't know if that relationship's going to last.
Oh, I don't think so.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm a little... That's a little...
Happy
a little,
Lover's Day.
Feels a little happy. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to take a look at some of those recipes, you can go to our It's a bad berry.
Yeah, it's very bad.
You can go to our website, Gina and Pat's recipes, including Get Your Man Chicken for Valentine's Day at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. No matter how I try, it's like the more you give, the more I want. And maybe that's no lie. Toyota's American Connection.
At Toyota Motor Manufacturing, Kentucky, Kentuckians build vehicles popular the world over. The Kentucky-built Toyota Camry, Avalon, and Camry Solara.
U.S.-made Toyotas are part of the global recall, and thousands of U.S. workers have no choice but to look to Tokyo to see how the Japanese auto giant responds to its worst crisis in history.
Getting to know you, putting it my way, but nicely.
American workers doing it Toyota's way, but nicely. On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, February 10th, and the takeaway is, what, if anything, are those U.S. workers who work for Toyota learning about their managers across the Pacific?
Well, and whether it's a foreign-owned company or not, those are still American jobs that are in danger down there in Kentucky. Let's get right to the top stories you're following this morning. Toyota at the top of the headlines again. More than 7,000 Camrys are being recalled because of a problem with their brakes. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. With Toyota's problems seemingly getting worse by the day, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood tells NBC News,
"We will not sleep until all of these cars are fixed properly and are safe to drive."
And the problems are not just limited to Toyota. Honda has added another 400,000 cars in the U.S. to its global recall for faulty airbags. Japan's number two automaker has been recalling cars since 2008. Today's latest expansion includes certain Accords, Civics, and Acuras.
Back to Toyota, though, there is a U.S. connection here, and it's not just consumers, people who own Toyotas. We're joined now by State Representative Charlie Hoffman from District 62 in Kentucky, which includes that Toyota plant we alluded to at the top of the hour. Representative Hoffman, good morning.
Good morning.
So have you gotten to know Toyota management a little better, for better or worse, in these last few weeks with all the recalls?
Yes, I have. I've had quite a bit of correspondence with them. They're letting us have information because they know we're probably going to be talking to a lot of people about the recall. And they seem to really be earnestly trying to keep us up with communications.
Well, we will see how confident that makes you and people of Kentucky feel when we talk a little more about what's going on down there in Kentucky as Toyota workers look to the future for their jobs. Representative Hoffman, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment.
Moving overseas, U.S. and Afghan forces have moved to the edge of the city of Marja, a major supply and drug smuggling stronghold for the Taliban. Earlier in The Takeaway, we asked Captain Abraham Sipe, a spokesman for Camp Leatherneck in the Helmand province, why is NATO publicizing this upcoming offensive?
The added risk that we might be taking by giving a warning is actually going to be outweighed by the benefits of letting the people know that, hey, this is what we're about to do, and we're doing it for the long-term safety and security of your homes.
You can hear that entire interview at our website, thetakeaway.org. Here at home, a severe snowstorm is sweeping into the Northeast this morning, bringing as much as a foot of snow to Washington, D.C., Baltimore, and Philadelphia.
President Obama used an impromptu news conference as an occasion to talk tough about Iran's nuclear program.
We're going to be working on over the next several weeks is developing a significant regime of sanctions that will indicate to them how isolated they are from the international community as a whole.
The sanctions will reportedly be aimed at Iran's Revolutionary Guard. And at the White House last night,
anybody here
seen my old friend Martin.
Smokey Robinson, among the people who were welcomed to the White House to celebrate Black History Month. Let's look at the markets now. Asian and European markets are up. Futures are up, too. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ opens at 2150. We're asking you this morning, do you have memories of a snow day of your youth? It's all over the East Coast. Snow days, 877-8-MY-TAKE or MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Toyota in Kentucky.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. We begin with those parallel universes in the U.S. car industry. While Detroit was shrinking over the last 20, 30 years, there's really been a rise in the manufacturing capacity of Japanese-owned factories in places like Kentucky and Tennessee. Have you visited any of those facilities?
I have been to several of them before, yeah.
Nissan plant in Tennessee. There's a Honda plant also, and we were talking about the Toyota plant there in Kentucky. It involves thousands and thousands of workers. These are typically non-union workers, but very much concerned about their jobs and very much concerned about the recalls coming out of Toyota that have certainly attracted the attention of the world and have lit a fire underneath the Toyota management in Japan.
A fire that they have never had to deal with before.
Indeed. Well, you're dealing with it now. State Representative Charlie Hoffman, representative of State House District 62 in Kentucky, the home of Toyota Motor Manufacturing Kentucky, the subsidiary there. Good morning again, Representative.
Good morning.
And also joining us is Marianne Keller, an automotive industry analyst and consultant and author of Collision, GM, Toyota, Volkswagen, and the Race to Own the 21st Century. Good morning, Marianne.
Good morning.
What do you think the issue is for American workers who work for some of these foreign-owned companies, particularly Toyota, with all the headlines and the safety issues and recalls that have been announced over the last few weeks? Marianne?
I think that you have to remember that that the factories in the United States are assembly plants. The cars are designed and engineered in Japan. So American workers are, to some extent, vulnerable to decisions that are made far away from where they actually produce the vehicles. I think that putting it into perspective, first, recalls are very common. Automobiles are very complex machines, and most of us have had one or more recalls on our vehicles, and we just take them back to the dealer and get them fixed because we expect that the manufacturer will stand behind the product and make the repair. In the case of Toyota, what went wrong in that process, which is normally virtually invisible, is the fact that the problems persisted over a number of years, and we can see that it goes back in some models back to 2005 model year product. And they seem to ignore the severity of it, forcing a member of the DOT staff to actually go to Japan to convey the importance of this and the seriousness of it is without precedent, I think. So I think that they failed really in understanding that they had a severe problem. They allowed the problem to get out of control. And then they, frankly, have not been able to contain the news around that problem.
Well, let's get a reaction from State Representative Charlie Hoffman. Marianne Keller has suggested that there's not a lot of manufacturing done at your plant. You do manufacture engines, I believe, at your plant in Kentucky. And how much confidence do you have, given that Toyota management has really been sort of caught with their pants down here?
Well, we understand the gravity here, especially locally, with the plant lines closing down for about 7 days and no production, we realize that it is a bad situation. Now the line has started back up; they're producing cars now, anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally because it is our largest employer. I think about 6,800 workers.
That's huge.
Yes, sir.
And And how vulnerable do those workers feel? I mean, these are non-union shops. Marianne Keller suggests that you're vulnerable because it's mostly an assembly operation. Do your workers and do your constituents, you're a Democratic representative in District 62, are they telling you that kind of thing?
No, because the Toyota officials assured, and there were no layoffs during the time all the plants, the workers came to the plant and did basically housekeeping functions, I think, during that time, and everyone so no one had to take time off during that time.
And that gives you confidence that at least management in Tokyo is trying to preserve jobs. Marianne Keller, is there precedent for Toyota looking out for workers, or maybe is there more of a precedent of them, doing the math and being a little more draconian in how they preserve jobs?
What Toyota has done in being able to keep the UAW out of its factories, frankly, is make two promises. First, that their compensation is effectively at a UAW rate. So if you're being paid essentially close to something that a UAW worker at GM makes, there's really not a financial incentive to join a union. And the second thing that Toyota has made good on, a promise of continuous employment. And so Toyota uses quite a few temporary workers who will sort of fill in the gaps when production lines are moving at breakneck speed and might be expendable when they're not. But the core of their workforce, the permanent workforce, has always had this promise of job security through thick and thin. And it's very traditional, very typical for them to come in and do training and housekeeping and other sort of non-assembly type jobs during periods like this. During model changeover, for example, there may be a week or so when the plant will not be running at full tilt. So this is characteristic, and this is how, frankly, they have been able to keep the UAW out of their factories. They're not the only ones. It's very common in most of the factories that don't have union representation.
Certainly Detroit has seen a radical shift in the economic realities of the auto business domestically. Are we likely to see a similar shift beginning with these recalls? Maybe it's not causal, but beginning with these recalls in the foreign-owned automakers in the United States?
I don't think that, we should be looking at Toyota and seeing that Toyota is about to go through, a multi-year slide the way GM did. I think that this has been a wake-up call for the management. They are a very, very effective team when it comes to engineering vehicles.
And we're going to see them in action because they're visiting the United States over the next few weeks. Some hopeful words there for workers in Kentucky. State Representative Charlie Hoffman and Marianne Keller, automotive industry analyst, talking about Toyota and the jobs that it has in the United States. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other stories we're following.
The government in Haiti says it now believes 230,000 people were killed in last month's earthquake. That's close to the number of people killed in the Asian tsunami 5 years ago. Meanwhile, the 10 American missionaries detained on child kidnapping charges in Haiti say the U.S. government could be doing more to help them. The group's Haitian lawyer says even the children's parents are opposing the kidnapping charges.
Parents of the kids testify under the judge that they gave the agreement to the orphanage to give the children to the American missionaries.
UNICEF says attempts are still being made to smuggle children out of Haiti to combat the problem. Specially trained officials are checking documents at the airport and the country's border. Back at home, it's snowing along the East Coast. Thousands of workers are scrambling to plow and salt roads as the blizzard descends upon states from Virginia to Connecticut.
Abroad, tens of thousands of public sector workers in Greece have taken to the streets. They're protesting the government's plans for tackling the nation's huge deficit. But most markets rose amid expectations the European Union will have a financial rescue for Greece. Astronauts for the Space Shuttle Endeavour say they're impressed with what they're seeing from the International Space Station. The crew received a warm welcome when they arrived and docked today. And as Ed Sullivan might have said long ago on our show, The Beatles. That's actual Beatle noise coming up. There's a way to keep the pests in check, and it involves that sound.
That's not the Beatles
more
I was thinking of.
In a few minutes, yeah, they're a little different.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time now for some takeouts on stories you're following this week. And, of course, Congress is closed today and probably for a few more days this week because of the blizzard heading all up and down the East Coast. But Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, it's not just that's the, not the only thing slowed down this week. The president seems to be upset that the process of confirming nominees has been slowed as well.
If the Senate does not act to confirm these nominees, I will consider making several recess appointments during the upcoming recess, because we can't afford to allow politics to stand in the way of a well-functioning government.
Todd Zwillick, what is a recess appointment?
Well, of course, as you know, Celeste, the Constitution gives the Senate the power of advice and consent. The president makes an appointment for someone in the administration. The Senate confirms them. But it also says if Congress is gone for whatever reason, the president can appoint someone during a recess. And that means the Senate is sort of out of the picture. These are very controversial. It drives senators nuts when presidents do this. You remember possibly that Democrats carped a lot when President Bush made recess appointments. In fact, John Bolton, former UN ambassador, he's been a guest on the show many times. He was recess appointed, and it drove Democrats crazy. Now the Democrats are talking about allowing the president to make recess appointments, and now it's driving Republicans crazy. Listen to Senator John Kyle. He's the Republican whip, and he seems to remember, you know, a couple of years ago when the tables were turned. Listen to this.
Democrats squealed when President Bush tried to do it as if it were something immoral and evil, and I would just ask people to be consistent in their view toward recess appointments. That was then, this is now.
Well, we'll see. Certainly nothing's going to get done this week because of the snow, or not much anyway. Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Our next takeout comes from São Paulo, Brazil. Paulo Cabral, BBC reporter in Brazil, joins us. So consider the fate of a populous nation with an epidemic of AIDS. What do? You take twice the population of Texas, you know, that number of condoms, and essentially dump it on the population. That's what's going on in the annual Carnival Festival, which begins on Saturday in Rio. Brazilian health officials think 55 million condoms can do the trick, Paulo?
Yes, well, actually, this campaign has been going on for the last 10 years. Every carnival, they distribute condoms and make these conscientization campaigns. Actually, the AIDS epidemic is pretty much under control in Brazil. It's actually getting out of hand again because since treatments have gotten better, what health officials understand is that people don't see AIDS anymore as such a bad thing as it was in the 80s and 90s when medicine was not so much available or efficient. So, yeah, they have launched now a campaign 1 week before Carnival incentivizing people to use condoms, and there will be another week of campaign after Carnival to incentivize people to test themselves if they did not use condoms during Carnival.
In the last 10 years of this program, has the Catholic Church changed its views on liberally distributing birth control like condoms?
Well, the Catholic Church often is against the distribution of condoms for contraceptive reasons. They do not say that much during Carnival. It's a huge festival. It's sort of a countrywide spring break with grown-ups taking part. So pretty much you don't see many people going against the distribution of condoms here.
Or going to church, for that matter. Paulo Cabral, BBC reporter in São Paulo, Brazil. Thanks so much.
And now let's talk about Beatlemania. That's Beetle. Bark beetles, the insects. They've been eating away at trees and leaving them dead. It's a terrible epidemic, and it's actually causing wildfires as well in the West. We're joined now by Richard Hofstetter, a forest entomologist at Northern Arizona University. And I believe, Richard, you guys think you've discovered a solution to the bark beetle that's been plaguing the West for years.
Yes, we have been looking at some alternatives, and we are looking at how bark beetles communicate acoustically, and that has led to some very interesting results where we've been able to affect their behaviors and maybe protect trees.
Well, you discovered that beetles were irritated by loud noises, and you tried playing loud rock music. You even tried playing Rush Limbaugh.
There's nothing to stop any of this. Nothing's stopping it.
But even that didn't scare these insects. What worked?
Yeah, what seemed to work is we manipulated sounds that were relevant to them. So we often targeted calls and sounds that they would make and play them back, and it seemed to influence behaviors. And so we were able to alter their interest in going into trees, cause a stressful environment, even sometimes kill each other.
So here's an example of a sound you're playing. This is the sound of their own, the beetles' bodily functions when they're eating at trees.
Oh, that's disgusting.
Really? It kind of sounds like a techno music underbeat.
I want to kill myself.
So Richard Hofstetter, why does this disturb the beetles?
Yeah, you know, that's the sound of aggressive male, and you know, when another male hears that sound, he responds in a very significant way, and so he usually will start to attack its neighbors. So, for instance, this male would attack a female that is tunneling with, and result in mortality. Yeah.
You're starting a bar fight.
That's essentially, yeah, exactly.
You're aggravating the males so that they start hitting each other.
Yeah. And in this case, it's often the female that's next to it. Yeah.
I love this. So, Richard Hofstetter, you've provided an insight as to why Rush Limbaugh doesn't affect me when I hear him, because he's not relevant, right?
Oh. That's true. And we found that the music and human voice didn't really affect them. After a while, they got used to the sound.
Is this effective? Can this actually wipe out all these beetles that have been terrorizing the West?
Well, I don't know if it's going to wipe them out, but maybe it can be used for individual tree protection, maybe high-value trees. It's really a device that we're looking at for individual trees.
Okay. Richard Hofstetter is an entomologist from Northern Arizona University's Forest Program. He joined us from Flagstaff, Arizona. Coming up, since the economic downturn, many Americans have had to tighten their belts. One of the things they're cutting back on? Child support payments. We're going to talk about the economy's effect on child support payments and what we can do about it in just a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the United States already had a problem with payments of child support. At least the courts are already having problems with that. Guess what happened after the recession? It's gotten worse. We're going to talk about that more in a few moments. First, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. Add 7,000 Camrys to the growing list of Toyota's recalls. There are problems with the brakes in some 2010 models. On top of that, government safety officials now say they're looking into a number of complaints with the steering on Toyota Corollas. Earlier this hour, we spoke to State Representative Charlie Hoffman from District 62 in Kentucky. That includes a Toyota plant that employs nearly 7,000 workers. He told us there haven't been any layoffs, but there is serious concern.
Anything that happens at the Toyota plant here in Georgetown is big news here locally, because it is our largest employer.
If you own one of the recalled Toyota Prius cars, the company says you'll start getting letters with information next week.
In Haiti, the government has raised the death toll for last month's earthquake to 230,000 now, making the disaster as deadly as the 2004 Asian tsunami. And officials say that number, 230,000, doesn't include bodies buried in private ceremonies. Further confirmation now this morning that Pakistan's Taliban leader is dead. This morning, Pakistan's top civilian security official offered the government's first official confirmation of the killing of the militant last month in a U.S. drone strike. Here at home, they're revising the so-called Bible of Psychiatry. The American Psychiatric Association is relabeling various disorders in its diagnostic manual. Some suggestions from experts so far include children who throw too many tantrums could be diagnosed with temper dysregulation with dysphoria. Men who are just way too interested in sex face being labeled as suffering from hypersexual disorder. And the experts also want binge eating and gambling to be registered as official mental disorders. Let's check the markets with our short attention span. Asian and European markets are up now. Futures are up, too, because of concerns about Greek debt actually getting solved. That's a positive force on the market. The Dow gets underway at 10,058. The S&P opens at 1,070, and the NASDAQ begins at 2150 when Wall Street starts trading later on this morning. Those are some of the stories we're following.
There's a lot of issues associated with a recession. We've talked on this program a lot about the difficulty in paying mortgages, the problems with finding a job. Today, we want to talk about the Americans who've been unable to pay child support. In Tennessee alone, child support payments are down $13 million from last year. We're joined by a woman who has to deal with this in her daily life. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in Tennessee, and she hears about many cases dealing with child support. We're also joined by Carlos Jarrett, a father of three in Tennessee, and he's had difficulty paying child support for one of his kids lately. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Magistrate Calloway, are you seeing an increase in cases dealing with child support in your courtroom?
We're definitely seeing an increase in cases, yes.
And what are are most of them coming from laid off parents?
They are coming from laid off parents. We're also getting a lot of cases where the state has generated petitions on behalf of the mother, or usually the mother, 9 times out of 10 of the mother, because she's having to receive state assistance. Whenever a woman receives any type of state assistance, they have to assess child support. And so we're seeing an increase in those types of cases.
Carlos, you pay child support for your 3-year-old daughter.
Yes.
And you're having trouble doing that lately. Why is that?
Just due to my income level staying the same, and all of my other expenses are increasing. Just everyday living expenses in addition to trying to maintain 2 other children.
So you have 2 children that live with you?
Yes.
And you pay child support for the third. You have not lost your job,
No.
but your other expenses have increased while your income has not gone up. Is that what's happened?
Correct.
You know, I have to, in the interest of full disclosure, I myself am a single mother who receives child support. That's a check that very often I've needed a lot. So, Carlos, I mean, for those who are on the other side, this is an issue for both sides. This is not just an issue for you, but for the caretaker of your child as well.
Right. But at the end of the day, I think we all have to understand that we're all in this thing together. And on some levels, we have to be able to bend a little. I would think it would be a good thing if we could, you know, maybe reduce it a little and have it where we may be able to just kind of pay, you know, so much extra, because you know as well as I know that even with the amount that you receive, there are other things that may come up that you may have to call your child's father, you know, for extra.
Go ahead.
So in my situation, when that happens, that becomes an extra burden. And I don't like for mine to go without, you know, for, you know, all, you know, everybody involved.
So, Magistrate Calloway, you must hear these kinds of cases all the time. How do you try to balance the interests of these 2 parents, both of whom may be struggling, but there's a child in there that still has to have clothing and food and proper care?
It's very difficult to balance on many levels, as Mr. Jarrett has said and as you have said as well. The bottom line is we've got to do what's best for the children. And I've told many fathers over and over again, if you have to do without, if, you know, as a mother, you may have to do without some things, but the child has to be taken care of. And if the child needs school supplies, the child needs food, clothing, the child might need extras, so that all of our children can achieve more than what we have, then we have to do without as a parent sometimes.
It seems like it would be complicated, though, because as you heard from Carlos, he has 2 kids he's taking care of at home, and he's saying that in order for him to meet the demands of the 1 kid who has court-ordered support, his 2 children that he's taking care of are sacrificing.
And sometimes that happens, and it is difficult. It's very difficult for the court. We have to follow the law and follow the guidelines that we're given in order to set support. And we are able at sometimes to deviate from the guidelines if we find good reason to do so. But a lot of times we just have to tell the parents that they're just going to have to either get a second job or just do a little more in order to take care of the kids.
So in your state, Magistrate, the state's collected $13 million less in child support than they collected last year?
I believe that's the correct numbers, yes.
Is the state having to step in some cases where parents just can't make up the difference?
In most of the cases that we receive the collections for, it is a state. The state is stepping in to get the collections. And once again, it says if they're receiving any type of state assistance, whether it's they're receiving insurance for the kids through the state or receiving any type of food stamps or any type of state assistance, then, yes, the state is going to step in to try and get the support payments.
Carlos, you heard the magistrate talking about making sacrifices when the kids need it. Your plea to have your support payments lowered was denied. Are you able to take a second job?
Well, anytime you do that, they add more support onto it because of your income, period. So anything extra that I do, I try to do with what I have. And as far as having a second job, that's just one of those things. You know, when you have two other kids to take care of, you can't get a second job because of the amount that it time that they require.
Okay.
So with that being said, second job is not something that I can do.
Okay. Carlos Jarrett, father of three in Tennessee. Sheila Jones Calloway is a magistrate in Tennessee as well, both of them out of Nashville. Coming up with the new renewed fight against obesity, I should say, one way to get people eating healthier is by moving it closer to you. We're going to talk about a group that's raising fish and produce there. They're in an industrial warehouse in the heart of Milwaukee. They get the food closer to them, and that helps them eat healthier. We're going to talk about that later this hour.
We're joined on a line with a little bit of delay from Islamabad, Pakistan. Jane Perlez, the New York Times correspondent in Pakistan, joins us with an interesting story this morning in the Times, which could represent Pakistan's effort to get back involved in the conflict in Afghanistan, or an attempt to really assist the United States in that conflict. Jane Perlez, has Pakistan and the military actually offered to mediate between NATO and the Taliban?
Well, I think it's early days right now, but I do think that the Pakistan military sees that the United States is not going to be in Afghanistan forever, and that talks are going to have to solve the situation in the end after fighting and talking and fighting and talking. To say that it's a formal offer is probably a little too bold, but they've certainly told the Americans that they want to be helpful or they want to be involved in bringing some of the irreconcilables along, and that would mean the Haqqanis who sit in North Waziristan.
And, you know, you describe a meeting attributed to a senior administration official that was a pretty high-level meeting.
I'm sorry, you've dropped.
Yeah, the meeting that you describe in your article.
I cannot hear you.
All right, Jane Perlez, who
I am very sorry, I'm
really can't hear us there from Islamabad, Pakistan. But you can go to our website where we link to the story that Jane Perlez has. It really involves the Pakistan in the middle of this offensive that's just beginning today, Celeste, in Helmand Province, a meeting last month between Stanley McChrystal, Mike Mullen, other NATO officials, and a Pakistani general who offered that possibly the Pakistan military could be a mediator with the Taliban. It's unclear how the U.S. would actually receive such an offer.
Well, it's also unclear how effective Pakistan would be, but the news that they're willing to take that role is encouraging, and because, you know, Pakistan has not always been eager to step in these particular conflicts.
And we should remind people, Jane Perlez, who has long experience as a correspondent in South Asia and particularly Pakistan, most recently cautioned this is not a formal offer, and it is, again, unclear whether this complicates the situation or actually assists the situation, but there is a long-standing relationship between the Pakistani military and U.S. forces. Our final takeout is the listener response to a story that we did earlier this week. Sierra Jones, her story was part of our series, The Value, with correspondent Farai Chidea. We looked at people's values in the face of tough economic and personal times.
I was actually in my first year of college in Tallahassee, Florida, on a scholarship, model student, and I ended up pregnant. So I decided to come back home and stay with my mom and try to do school here. It was never really a good situation at my mom's home ever since I was younger. So eventually it led to them giving me a day to find somewhere to live.
Well, Ciara Jones' story, and you can see more of it on our website, thetakeaway.org, really caused a conversation to begin on our website.
That's right. Robert posted, "This story is awful. Yet another single mother, yet another child brought into the world under the worst possible circumstances. No mention of the child's father, no mention about the child. The subject of the story is not a hero. She is yet another woman who's advanced the decline of the American family in general and the black family in specific."
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Can you get farm fresh produce if you live in the heart of Manhattan or Los Angeles? We're going to talk to one person who's growing produce and farming, fishing for fish in a downtown Milwaukee warehouse. More on that in a few moments. First, let's check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Honda takes center stage in automotive news today. A recall over airbags that started more than a year ago has ballooned to nearly a million Hondas worldwide. Sticking with safety, the FAA is close to wrapping up a two-year investigation of violations at American Airlines. The result could be one of the largest fines in the agency's history, expected to be around $10 million. Officials say the investigation involves problematic wiring that could be a fire hazard. And former Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich heads to court today to answer revised charges that he tried to sell President Obama's old Senate seat. His defense attorney says the arraignment should be routine with a simple not guilty plea.
Powerful storms brought heavy snow to the Midwest and is now coating parts of the East. Bob Orovec is the lead forecaster at the National Weather Service. He has some details.
The current storm system will abate later in the day on Wednesday for the Washington, D.C. area and be done by Thursday in the New York City area. And after that, we have a fairly tranquil weekend, but there is some signs of another storm potential earlier in the week or early next week along the East Coast.
This storm has grounded hundreds of flights from New Jersey to Washington. In New York City, the public schools are closed for only the third time in the past 6 years. In Afghanistan, on the eve of what appears to be a major NATO assault into Helmand Province, more than 150 people have been killed in avalanches that blocked the mountain pass north of Kabul. More than 2,000 people have been rescued so far. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
First Lady Michelle Obama is fired up.
We have to act. So let's move. Let's get this done. Let's move to get families and communities together to make healthy decisions for their kids.
That is her kicking off her campaign called Let's Move. It's a White House initiative to fight childhood obesity. Will Allen was actually at the press conference with the First Lady yesterday. He's been working with local communities to help them gain access to healthy food. He's the CEO of Growing Power, a nonprofit urban farming outfit that teaches city dwellers how to grow food. Good morning, Will.
Good morning.
One thing that First Lady Michelle Obama talked about yesterday is food deserts, and we've been hearing about a lot about this lately. What is a food desert?
Well, my definition is an area where there's no real access to good food, where there are no grocery stores, where you have a very dense population, where you have to travel, 3-4 miles before you get to a retail grocery store, with many people in low-income communities not having cars, transportation. It's kind of not very practical to get on a bus and go pick up significant amounts of food, especially for those families that have children.
And there's a lot of urban areas that are like this. I lived in Detroit for a long time. Many places in Detroit are a so-called food desert where people had have to travel a long way to get any kind of fresh food. How do you solve that? You certainly can't. It's a difficult thing to bring the people to the food or solve the public transportation part of it.
Right. Well, one of the ways, of course, is one of the things that we found in our work is that in every community there is a daycare center, a school, or a social service agency, and those places could become food centers where food could be dropped via CSA type box that we do called Market Basket, where we drop a bag of food, about 14 different fruits and vegetable items each week. It's enough to feed a family of four for a week with those items. And that's been a very effective way to get food into those communities, to really partner with those agencies.
So one of the things that you have done on your own is you've started this company called Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. And what you do is really kind of amazing to me. You actually take old warehouses and industrial spaces and you use something called aquaponic agriculture to turn them into farms.
Well, I bought the last remaining farm in the city of Milwaukee in 1993, and over the years it's grown to a national, international training center for urban agriculture and small-scale farming. So folks come from all over the country now to get trained in how to grow more intensively, because the fact is that we've lost a lot of our ag land, and a lot of our ag land is occupied by growing commodities such as soybeans and corn to produce mostly sugars.
Right.
So what we're doing is getting folks in the city to grow food, really take control and responsibility of growing their own food, because urban agriculture isn't something new. People have been growing food for years in their backyards and side yards, very silently, but because of the dense population and the fact that more people are moving into cities worldwide, it's going to be necessary. It's not a choice. We just have to, if we want to eat good food, we're going to have to grow some of it ourselves and have farmers markets, farm stands,
Let's explore that a little bit. Will Allen, of course, CEO of Growing Power, which is a nonprofit urban farming initiative. You know, this is way more, considerably more than just some, if you'll, you know, forgive me, smushy, just social program for neighborhoods, urban neighborhoods. This is a serious business model. There's a community garden right down from where I live in Brooklyn that's next to one of the biggest projects in in Brooklyn and in the United States, really. And they grow tons of fresh produce, and some of it goes to the neighborhood, but they also sell high-value produce to the restaurant trade in the city. You can actually make money doing this. Isn't that true?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we have 40 employees, a budget of about $3 million now. And we have a very diversified marketing scheme to get food to everybody, not only folks in those communities, but to be able to fund ourselves and create jobs. We're marketing to corporate cafeterias, to school systems, the Milwaukee public school system. We deliver food right from the same city, right into the school system,
but
restaurants.
Will, are there environmental issues if you're doing aquaculture? I mean, that could be some pretty smelly stuff if you're talking about ponds with fish like catfish and carp.
Well, no, it really, really isn't. These systems are natural systems, recirculating systems that cost a fraction of what commercial systems cost. For every gallon of water, you can grow a fish. So these systems are inside greenhouses and inside buildings in Milwaukee, and we're raising thousands of fish. And these systems can be easily replicated. Folks are coming from all over the world to learn how to build these really pretty simple systems that require one pump to move the water, and gravity and water pressure moves the water through plants. So it's called aquaponics, and it's a symbiotic relationship between the plants and the fish. So you get two crops. You get vegetables, and you also get fish.
You know, that Michelle Obama talked about her wake-up moment when she realized that she needed to take on this issue, and I can't help but think of your journey here. You were a professional basketball player in Europe, and then you became a district sales manager for Kentucky Fried Chicken, and I looked up Kentucky Fried Chicken, like a basic meal there. We're talking about meals that are about 1,000 calories or so a piece. It's not extraordinarily healthy food. And now you've come into this to do urban agriculture and growing watercress and fresh fish. How did you get here?
Well, I actually grew up on a farm right outside of Washington, D.C., on the border of Bethesda and Rockville. So I come from a farm background, went to college, played professional basketball, and wound up in Europe, where I got reacquainted with farming, because the Europeans actually grow healthy food the way we did when I was growing up. So that was my wake-up call, that something was missing in my life. And once I got back here, of course, I had going into farming is a very expensive thing, and I, to make a long story short, I took some corporate jobs, which for a time, and until I was able to purchase a farm. I farm 100 acres of my own farm, and then I bought this farm in the city.
And now you're growing food for lots and lots of people and telling people other people how to do it, too. Will Allen is the CEO of Growing Power. It's a nonprofit urban farming initiative. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Sort of the real agricultural end of the Let's Move program. So go to our website. You can see more about that urban farm. And as always, you can nominate who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friend at The Week magazine.
My name is Daniel, calling from Beaufort, South Carolina. My nominee for who's having a good week is Jenny Sanford, who's been on pretty much every television show, and in every newspaper for the past week. For who's having a bad week, I would say her husband, who's alone in the governor's mansion.
That's your nomination. You can join us at 877-8MYTAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org and tune in on Friday to the Week segment from The Week magazine. Good week, bad week. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.